Hello, and welcome to the first 10 pages. What is this? We do script analysis here, and what we discuss specifically, as you might have guessed, are the first 10 pages of a screenplay. The reason we do that is because in Hollywood they say, if you don't grab your reader within the first 10 pages, that script gets tossed out. You've lost them. You've lost the studio. You've lost your chances at living your dream. You've lost everything. You might as well go live in a ditch. On the other hand, in the first 10 pages, even though it's not the first act of the movie, that's about 30 pages, by the way, what it does is it sets tone, it sets up the characters. A lot of what you see in a movie is within the first 10 pages. And who am I? I'm Keith, and I'm a screenwriter. You haven't heard of me. I've only done some script doctoring, and I've gotten some accolades here and there. Yeah? Okay, let's talk scripts. Today, what we're discussing, 1994's Pulp Fiction! In case you don't know it, why are you here? But what is Pulp Fiction? It is a dark and violent crime movie that was smart enough to be considered art house cinema at its time. It's not the movie that put Quentin Tarantino, the film's director and mostly its writer, on the map, but that was Reservoir Dogs, by the way. But it is the one that made him a household name. Pulp Fiction starred, amongst other people, Samuel Jackson. It was the movie he was most identified with for nearly a decade. It gave renewed energy to John Travolta's career, for better or worse. And it raked in over $200 million on an under $10 million budget. This podcast will break down this way. There'll be an annoying introduction like this one. And then there'll be a script read, which will also be really annoying, because I'm going to read the entire first 10 pages. I mean, I don't wanna, but it's kind of important because I can't guarantee that everybody's going to be able to find the script. And if we are going to discuss a script, then someone's got to read it and it's going to be me. But I will give a timestamp so you can skip it. So that'll help a lot probably for all the people that go, oh God, I don't want to skip it. And that would be me in most cases, but not in this case because I'm going to read it. So there. Then we'll discuss the different elements of the script that are introduced in the first 10 pages and how those elements affect the rest of the script and thus the movie that we saw on screen. Does that sound great? Great. I didn't really give you a chance to answer because I don't care. I can't hear you. Come on. Let's get to a quick read of the script. My Tim Roth, by the way, might sound a lot like Michael Caine. Just roll with it. We're just having fun, you know? My narrator, probably going to sound a little like Quentin Tarantino. Not the whole time, but because reading a script aloud without other people is kind of boring, I decided to have some fun. I should warn you, this is a warning. Pay attention, warning. Offensive language follows. Now, it's very possible the platform that I'm putting this on is going to make me eliminate or censor that language. In my opinion, it's Quentin Tarantino's art. It shouldn't be censored. However, the platform might feel otherwise. If the platform does not feel otherwise, you will hear things like the N-word and other very offensive language because, again, that is how Quentin Tarantino writes. So keep that in mind as you continue. My apologies in advance for all the offensive and disparaging, horrible terms that appear in the script. The words are not repeated outside of the script reading, okay? If you want to skip the script reading, you can go to this timestamp. 14 minutes, 16 seconds. Pulp. Noun. 1. A soft, moist, shapeless mass or matter. 2. A magazine or book containing lurid subject matter and being characteristically printed on rough, unfinished paper. American Heritage Dictionary, New College Edition. Interior coffee shop. Morning. A normal Denny's, Spires-like coffee shop in Los Angeles. It's about 9:00. Just so you know how it's typed, in the morning. While the place isn't jammed, there's a healthy number of people drinking coffee, munching on bacon, and eating eggs. Two of these people are a young man and a young woman. The young man has a slight working-class English accent and, like his fellow countrymen, smokes cigarettes like they're going out of style. It is impossible to tell where the young woman is from or how old she is. Everything she does contradicts something she did. The boy and girl sit in a booth. Their dialogue is to be said in a rapid pace, His Girl Friday fashion. Young man. No, forget it. It's too risky. I'm through doing that shit. You always say that the same thing every time. Never again. I'm through. Too dangerous. Oh, no. That's what I always say. I'm always right, too. But
But you forget about it in a day or two. Yeah, well, the days of me forgetting are over. And the days of me remembering have just begun. When you go on like this, you know what you sound like? I sound like a sensible fucking man, is what I sound like. You sound like a duck. Quack, 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 quack. Well, take art, because you're never going to have to hear it again. Because since I'm never going to do it again, you're never going to have to hear me quack about how I'm never going to do it again. After tonight.
The boy and girl laughed, their laughter putting a pause in their back and forth.
Correct. I got all night to quack.
A waitress comes by with a pot of coffee.
Can I get anybody any more coffee? Oh, yes, thank you.
The waitress pours the young woman's coffee. The young man lights up another cigarette.
I'm doing fine.
The waitress leaves. The young man takes a drag off of his smoke. The young woman pours a ton of cream and sugar into her coffee. The young man goes right back into it.
I mean, the way it is now, you're taking the same fucking risk as when you rob a bank. You take more of a risk. Banks are easier. Federal banks aren't supposed to stop you anyway during a robbery. They're insured. Why should they care? You don't even need a gun in a federal bank. I heard about this guy walked into a federal bank with a portable phone, handed the phone to the teller. The guy on the other end of the phone said, "We got this guy's little girl, and if you don't give him all your money, we're gonna kill her." Did it work? Fucking A, it worked. That's what I'm talking about. Knucklehead walks in a bank with a telephone, not a pistol, not a shotgun, but a fucking phone, cleans the place out, and they don't lift a fucking finger. Did they hurt the little girl? I don't know. There probably never was a little girl. The point of the story isn't the little girl. The point of the story is they robbed the bank with a telephone. You want to rob banks? I'm not saying I want to rob banks. I'm just illustrating that if we did, it would be easier than what we've been doing. So you don't want to be a bank robber? No, all those guys are going down the same road. Either dead or 720. And no more liquor stores. What have we been talking about? Yeah, no more liquor stores. Besides, it ain't the giggle it used to be. Too many foreigners own liquor stores. Vietnamese, Koreans, they can't fucking speak English. You tell them, empty out the register, and they don't know what it fucking means. They make it too personal. We keep on, one of those gook motherfuckers gonna make us kill them. I'm not gonna kill anybody. I don't wanna kill anybody either. But they'll probably put us in a situation where it's us or them. And if it's not the gooks, it's these old Jews who've owned the store for 15 fucking generations. You got Grandpa Irvin sitting behind the counter with a fucking Magnum. Try walking into one of those stores with nothing but a telephone. See how far it gets you. Fuck it. Forget it. We're out of it. Well, what else is there? Day jobs?
Not this life.
Well, what then?
He calls to the waitress.
Garçon, coffee.
Then looks to his girl.
This place.
The waitress comes by, pouring him some more.
Garçon.
Means boy. She splits.
Here? It's a coffee shop. What's wrong with that? People never rob restaurants, why not? Bars, liquor stores, gas stations, you get your head blown off sticking up one of them. Restaurants, on the other hand, you catch with their pants down. They're not expecting to get robbed, or not as expecting.
Young woman, taking to the idea.
I bet in places like this you could cut down on the hero factor. Correct. Just like banks, these places are insured. The managers don't give a fuck. They're just trying to get you out the door before you start plugging diners. Waitresses, forget it. They ain't taking a bullet for the register. Busboys, some wetback getting paid $1.50 an hour. Gonna really give a fuck you're stealing from the owner. Customers are sitting there with food in their mouths. They don't know what's going on. One minute they're having a Denver omelet, next minute somebody's sticking a gun in their face.
The young woman visibly takes in the idea. The young man continues in a low voice.
See, I got the idea. Last liquor store we stuck up. Remember all those customers kept coming in? Yeah. Then you got the idea to take everybody's wallet. Uh-huh. That was a good idea. Thanks. We made more from the wallets than we did the register. Yes, we did. A lot of people go to restaurants. A lot of wallets. Pretty smart, huh?
The young woman scans the restaurant with this new information. She sees all the patrons eating, lost in conversations. The tired waitress taking orders, the busboys going through the motions, collecting dishes. The manager complaining to the cook about something. A smile breaks out on the young woman's face.
Pretty smart. I'm ready. Let's go. Right here. Right now. Remember, same as before. Your crowd control. I handle the employees. Got it.
They both take out their .32 caliber pistols and lay them on the table. He looks at her and she back at him.
I love you, pumpkin. I love you, honey bunny.
And with that, Pumpkin and Honey Buddy grab their weapons, stand up, and rob the restaurant. Pumpkin's robbery persona is that of the in-control professional. Honey Buddy's is that of the psychopathic, hair-triggered loose cannon. Pumpkin, yelling to all, "Everybody be cool! This is a robbery!
Any of you fucking pricks, move and I'll execute every one of you motherfuckers! Got that?"
Cut to, credit sequence, Pulp Fiction. Interior, 74 Chevy, moving, morning. An old, gas-guzzling, dirty white 1974 Chevy Nova barrels down a homeless-ridden street in Hollywood. In the front seat are two young fellas, one white, one black, both wearing cheap black suits with thin black ties under long green dusters. Their names are Vincent Vega, white, and Jules Winfield, black. Jules is behind the wheel. "Okay, now, tell me about the hash bars."
"What do you want to know?"
"Well, hash is legal there, right?"
"Yeah, it's legal, but it ain't 100% legal. I mean, you can't walk into a restaurant, roll a joint, and start puffing away. You're only supposed to smoke in your home or certain designated places."
"Those are hash bars."
"Yeah, it breaks down like this. It's legal to buy it, it's legal to own it, and if you're the proprietor of a hash bar, it's legal to sell it. It's legal to carry it, which doesn't really matter because, get a load of this, if the cops stop you, it's illegal for them to search you. Searching you is a right that the cops in Amsterdam don't have."
"That did it, man. I'm fucking going. That's all there is to it."
"You'll dig it the most, but you know what the funniest thing about Europe is?"
"What?"
"It's the little differences. A lot of the same shit we got here, they got there. But there, they're a little different. Examples. Well, in Amsterdam, you can't buy beer in a movie theater. And I don't mean in a paper cup either. They give you a glass of beer like in a bar. In Paris, you can buy beer at McDonald's. Also, you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?"
"No, they got the metric system there. They wouldn't know what the fuck a quarter pounder is."
"What'd they call it?"
"A Royale with cheese."
"Royale with cheese.
What'd they call a Big Mac?" "Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac."
"Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?"
"I don't know. I didn't go into Burger King. But you know what they put on French fries in Holland instead of ketchup?"
"What?"
"Mayonnaise.
God damn!
I seen them do it. And I don't mean a little bit on the side or the plate. They fucking drown them in it. Ugh."
Cut to. Interior Chevy trunk. Morning. The trunk of the Chevy opens up. Jules and Vincent reach inside, taking out two 45 automatics, loading and cocking them.
"We should have shotguns for this kind of deal."
"How many up there?"
"Three or four, counting your guy."
"I'm not sure."
"So there could be five guys up there?"
"It's possible."
"We should have fucking shotguns."
They close the trunk. Cut to. Exterior, apartment building, courtyard, morning. Vincent and Jules, their long matching overcoats practically dragging on the ground, walk through the courtyard of what looks like a Hacienda-style Hollywood apartment building. We track alongside.
"What's her name?"
"Mia."
"How did Marcellus and her meet?"
"I don't know. However people meet people. She used to be an actress."
"She ever do anything I would have saw?"
"I think her biggest deal was she starred in a pilot."
"What's a pilot?"
"Well, you know the shows on TV?"
"I don't watch TV."
"Yes, but you're aware that there's an invention called television, and on that invention they show shows?"
"Yeah."
"Well, the way they pick the shows on TV is they make one show, and that show's called a pilot, and they show that one show to the people who pick the shows, and on the strength of that one show, they decide if they want to make more shows. Some get accepted and become TV programs, and some don't, and become nothing.
She starred in one of the ones that became nothing." They enter the apartment building. Interior reception area, apartment building, morning. Vincent and Jules walk through the reception area and wait for the elevator.
"You remember Antoine Rocamora, half black, half Samoan? Used to call him Tony Rocky Horror?"
"Yeah, maybe. Fat, right?"
"I wouldn't go so far to call the brother fat. He's got a weight problem. What's the nigga gonna do? He's Samoan."
"I think I know who you mean. What about him?"
"Well, Marcellus fucked his ass up good. And word around the campfire, it was on account of Marcellus Wallace's wife."
The elevator arrives. The men step inside. Interior elevator morning.
"What'd he do? Fuck her?"
No. Nothing that bad."
"Well, what then?"
"He gave her a foot massage."
"A foot massage."
Jules nods his head yes.
"That's all." Jules nods his head yes.
Okay, well, that wasn't too bad. That was kind of fun, right? Right? Yeah, maybe. Some elements that are set up and reappear throughout the film include the title over, which is the black screen with the definition of pulp. The tone, comedy violence and snappy dialogue intertwining, time jumps, and of course, unusual and engaging characters who are not such great people, robbers, murderers, and things like that. So let's discuss these elements, okay? Let's talk about the title over. Title over, with its definition of pulp, lurid subject matter, sets up a number of other title overs we get later on in the movie. The phrase title over, by the way, is a script term. Most viewers in this movie, anyway, would probably just call them title cards. In other movies, the words might just appear over the scene itself. You know, how you might see in some movies, the military time, if it's a military movie, or in a Marvel movie, they like to show the location across the whole screen sometimes, and things like that. In this case, we get the definition of pulp. We see Vincent Vega and Marcellus Wallace's wife as a title, the gold watch as a title. Opening with the definition of Pulp Fiction as a title sets us up for the return of the title overs throughout the rest of the film. Without that, the definition, I mean. The first time a title actually appears is about 15 minutes in, which is a long time for that to occur. If we didn't get the title over at the beginning with the definition of pulp, you as a viewer would be like, oh, wait, we're getting titles? Is that what's going on now? It would throw you off. So it was a very smart move by Tarantino to start off with the definition of Pulp Fiction, which wasn't necessarily a requirement, but it does help the structure of the movie. Everything is strategic in good script writing, and Tarantino is an expert at this. Let's talk Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. You heard from the two of them in the script read. They don't just help set up the movie's start and end, by the way. They define everything about the film. In the script, they're just referred to as young man and young woman. In the closing scroll of the film, they are referred to as Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. I remember people being very excited about those two characters, by the way. That was two characters, by the way. My generation remembers this well. Let's jump right back into who they are as characters. They are violent people. They are angry people. Not at each other, but at the world, apparently. They love each other. And the thing that they bond over, that they have their love for, is holding people up, taking their money, pointing guns at them, and maybe shooting one or two of them. There's romance here. They have a shared love of robbing people. It seems to be kind of foreplay for them. And foreplay for me. Wait, what is foreplay? I'll look it up later. Perhaps the most apt thing is that these characters are the first in this movie, and not the last, to romanticize crime. It's a theme throughout the film. Don't mistake me. The movie doesn't romanticize crime, but the characters do, over and over and over. In the script, by the end of page 2, getting back to our first 10 pages theme, it's clear that these two are planning to rob people, hurt people, maybe both. And that's all you need to know about the kind of people you're going to meet in the movie. That is everything that this movie essentially is about. People who hurt people and the after effects of doing so. It comes up with Jules and Vincent, Samuel Jackson and John Travolta's characters. Comes up with them a few times. It becomes a running theme. It's actually the arc of their characters. The joke in the middle of the movie about a character named Marvin who gets shot in the face. There's the results of that. Obviously, Marcellus Wallace gets hurt and how he responds and how the people hurting him are enjoying that. It's a thing that comes back. And it's all set up in those first 10 pages. In terms of other elements, I want to talk about another really interesting thing that's in there. When Tarantino describes Honey Bunny, he lets us know that she has a persona. And I find that interesting. Early in that conversation, she actually says to Pumpkin that she doesn't want to kill anybody, or she's not going to kill anybody, one or the other. But then when she stands up, we all know that moment when she stands up and goes, "And if you motherfuckers fucking move," or whatever the line is. You know, she's frightening. And Tarantino makes a point, not just in the implication of "I'm not going to kill anybody" in the dialogue, but by saying it in the action, that is a persona. That is not who she is. That's an act she puts on. Why he put it in the action, I can only guess. I would assume perhaps it's just for his actors to know where he's coming from on these characters so that they could look at it that way. Another interesting element of Tarantino's descriptions of his action is the way he describes Vincent and Jules. That year, the following year, probably for a few years after this movie, there were a lot of guys who were being cool, or just what they were wearing to high school were dark suits and dusters, right? But Tarantino makes a point of saying that their dark suits are cheap and their dusters are dragging on the ground, virtually, or dragging, whatever the line is. Again, I don't have it in front of me at this point. It's interesting. So Jules and Vincent aren't cool. Everybody thought they were cool, but On the other hand, perhaps we should have been clued in by that based on their hairstyles. I mean, a Jerry curl? Really?
Let's talk romance!
Romance is also a theme in the film. Potential romance between Vincent Vega and Mia Wallace, Bruce Willis's Butch, and the love affair he has with his girlfriend. Even Eric Stoltz's drug dealer character has a dedicated live-in girlfriend and a very domesticated life, which is used for fodder and humor. Outside of him just being a drug dealer, he's got a nice little, you know, deal going on there with his girlfriend. Everything is lovely and wonderful in their life, it seems, right? And of course, let's not forget the most perfect of romances in this movie, the one that everyone thinks of, the one that has stood the test of time and is to this day referred to pretty regularly. Yes, I'm talking Marcellus Wallace and the Gimp. It's a love forged in heaven, after all.
In all seriousness, romance is peppered throughout the script and the movie, and it is set up in the first moments of that script with Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. They playfully give each other shit and compliment one another, talk about the love and the admiration they have for each other. Without it being said outright, of course. I mean, there's no,
I so admire you for this or that.
You know, it's smarter and snappier than that, but it's there right from the get-go. Let's talk a macabre sense of humor.
The bizarre sense of humor, the bizarre, dark humor of this movie permeates the whole script. Roth's character tells us a story, again in those first 10 pages, about a kidnapped little girl. And when Plummer asks about that little girl, he says, "I don't give a fuck. That's not even the point."
But he says it in a British accent, not whatever the hell that just was. Not only do they have no issue with crime and mayhem and murder and the deaths of children, the way it comes across to the viewer because of Tarantino's approach in the script is comedic. It's comedy. It's fun. Later on, when more mayhem occurs because of the Pumpkin Honey Bunny banter, we're ready to laugh. I'm referring, of course, to Marvin getting shot in the face. That elicits a huge laugh from whoever I'm watching it with. In the crowd, when I saw it in the theaters, I remember that moment. Bruce Willis choosing his weapons in the pawn shop to save Marcellus while he's being raped in the back room. And, you know, Tarantino being Tarantino, he doesn't shy about what's going on in that back room. It's very clear that dude is being raped. In the front room, we have this slow comedy moment unfolding as Bruce Willis is skulking around trying to figure out what's the best weapon to go back in there and kick some ass with. And again, it's not just the juxtaposition that's funny, it's the darkness of it that's funny. When I saw this in the movie theater, when I was but a wee lad, I was a teenager. I remember the second time my friend and I went to see it. It was not a packed house, it was probably maybe a fifth full, if that. And diagonally in front of us was a woman who was probably in her 60s or 70s, sitting there on her own to watch this movie. Throughout the movie, she had no reaction to anything. She just sat there and looked around, stoic. She was not enjoying herself. Then came the moment when Marvin was shot in the face. And the audience, they all laughed. And the woman, I remember looking at her, and she looked around. She looked back at us, actually, and continued to look around. She had an owl's head. She was actually able to do a 360-degree turn with her head. And she took in all the people laughing at the dude's head exploding inside the car. And for the first time in that movie, she laughed. She finally realized, like, oh, it's not just a crime movie. It's not a drama. I'm not supposed to take this seriously. For the rest of that movie, she laughed at the things that were dark and funny that everybody else laughed at. Took her a while to get on board, but once she was on board, she was in there. So for her, I guess maybe the first 10 pages didn't work, but it's still a story that I enjoy sharing because I find it fascinating. Okay, we're going to move on. Let's talk location!
We're not explicitly told it's LA in the film. At least not in the first 10, 20 minutes. It might come up later on. There's no shots of palm trees or a montage of bikini-clad women while Randy Newman sings at a piano in the corner. But the aesthetic does feel like LA, or at least a place like LA, from the style of the lensing and the brightness. You know, the brightness, the sunny day, Tim Ross Hawaiian shirt, the generally laid-back feel of the characters and the locales. It feels like LA, even though there's not a single shot of the Hollywood sign. All of this is on screen. When we examine the script, there's just one line stating in the opening that we're in a Los Angeles diner. For a script, that's enough, usually. Any director could have chosen other ways to show that it's a Los Angeles diner. Tarantino does it with an aesthetic, not a static shot of anything typically LA, you know, like palm trees against a hilly backdrop or a shot of the Hollywood and Vine street signs or or Angeline billboards, or the Beverly Hills Hotel, or all those things that you see in a ton of other movies. I have nothing more to say on location, so we're going to move on.
Let's talk structure!
There's an early time jump in the script. Within our first 10 pages, which is also the first 10 minutes of the movie, we cut to new characters and learn later that we've jumped back in time in that moment. That strange jump, ending the opening sequence on what is essentially a cliffhanger, playing the title's music and then bringing us to a wholly new LA location, is jarring, but not in a bad way. It revs you up to want to see more of the same. We get it immediately that with the now famous banter, right after the titles, the now famous banter of, you know, the whole Royale with cheese conversation. Keeps up the fun dialogue, keeps up the tone that we set up in the opening scene. We segue into talk about sex before they enter an apartment and threaten a bunch of young guys. We understand through that cut that the film is going to be episodic, even for the viewers who don't know what that means. We know that we'll be visiting different people and different stories. Heck, Honey Bunny and Pumpkin's story could have ended on them pulling out their guns. All that banter was leading to a robbery, and we kind of knew it was leading to a robbery. That's all they were talking about. And then they pull said robbery. Had we never come back to them, our imaginations would have just filled in the rest. We would assume that they pulled that robbery and, per their conversation, continued on with a lifelong career of robbing diners, drive-ins, and dives, and all of us hoping that Guy Fieri got caught in the crossfire along the way. The only sense we get that these stories will all connect is a very brief moment when Vincent and Jules have a brief interaction with Bruce Willis's Butch. That does not happen in the first 10 pages. However, in the first 10 pages, when Pumpkin and Honey Bunny are talking, there is a moment where Vincent walks by in the background. We don't recognize him, we don't know he's there. But later on, at the end of the film, when we see the other angle of the diner, and Jules and Pumpkin have a confrontation, we now know that when Vincent walked off, he walks right by characters that we know, you know, Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. We see that there was a crossover, as it were. More interestingly, if you listen very closely to the conversation between Pumpkin and Honey Bunny early on, around the time that he says garçon, just before it, I believe, is when Jules and Vincent are getting into an argument. If you listen closely, you can hear bits and pieces of that argument amongst the background noise of people in the diner. So there is, in the first 10 minutes, although not directly mentioned in the script, there is no action description of, we hear Vincent and Jules in the background, or Vincent walks by in the background. There's nothing like that that is mentioned in the script. To be fair, Quentin was writing that script for himself. He didn't have to mention it. He knows it's happening. He knew what he was going to put on the screen. If you were writing it for a different director, you would probably mention that. That would probably be something that you'd put in there, so that way someone reading it for potential to create your script into a film, it would be something that they would want to potentially know. Or you can do what Quentin did and leave it for later on. To give a little perspective to all of this timeline stuff, just very quickly, we meet Pumpkin and Honey Bunny, then Vincent and Jules while they're on their way to kill someone who ripped off Marcellus. That sequence essentially ends the now famous Ezekiel speech from Samuel Jackson. We then get the title over telling us all of that was just a setup for the story of Vincent Vega and Marcellus Wallace's wife. From the story of the two of them, we go to Bruce Willis's story. From Willis's story, we cut to the guy hiding in a room, and we hear Samuel Jackson's Ezekiel speech again. So we know exactly where we are. The hiding guy pulls a gun, shoots at Jackson's Jules and Vincent Vega, misses them completely, and thus changes everything about Jules's life. Leaving that location, they shoot Marvin in the face, deal with that problem, eventually over to the diner where Jules drops the bomb on Vega. So now we know that Vincent is alone, searching for Bruce Willis, who's on the run. He's alone because Jules has left the game, and in what is clearly his first assignment for Wallace without his pal Jules, he gets himself killed. We then cut to the diner. This is where Jules tells Vincent he's going to walk the earth and that God will put him where he needs to be. So the guy who respects the Almighty goes off to live his life, and the guy who is quick to anger, impatient, and is a dope fiend, who fills his body with the worst food and doesn't respect himself or the earth per Jules, as soon as he loses his guardian angel, he's killed. But the guy who doesn't dine on pork, who reads the Bible, who's patient and respectful throughout the film, lives on. What's the commentary? Beats the fuck out of me. Those folks aren't exactly redeemable, but it's interesting to note that the comparatively worst guy gets gunned down when he loses his only friend in the world. Let's talk the first 10 pages! Yes, that's right, we're getting back to the beginning. We've come full circle. Just like the script, we end where it began, the diner. We now know everything we need to know about Jules when he's confronted by Pumpkin in the final scene. We also know that what we're seeing here is prior to Vincent's death. And we come to realize that this is the scene that explains how and why Vincent's death and the fact that he was alone in that location happened. it's probably the kind of thing that you don't realize necessarily when you're watching it. It kind of registers when you're leaving, you're talking to your friends like, hey, wait a second. Weren't they wearing the t-shirts? And if they're wearing the t-shirts and Jules wasn't, oh my God. And you have that kind of moment. The movie's become such a part of pop culture. People probably forget what the initial feeling was when that movie came out. You know, the idea of playing with our expectations has become much more mainstream with filmmakers like Nolan, Jordan Peele, and Night Shyamalan. At any rate, it's really easy to forget that all those jumps in time and the changes in narrative weren't something that writers and directors were doing at the time. It wasn't something you'd see quite so often as we see it now. Heck, if those other guys would start including more random, unnecessary violence and the N-word, they'd really have something. Oh, no, they shouldn't do that. Please don't write me letters. Just don't message me, okay? My point is that Jules in that last scene gets closure thanks to his confrontation with Pumpkin. Pumpkin and Honey Bunny get their own kind of closure. It seems that they're just gonna go on with a new kind of life of crime and be happily ever after. It brings the stories of those three characters to a natural end. Meanwhile, Vincent Vega's story has already ended in the previous scene. We know this, but Vincent Vega doesn't know that. In sum, thanks to a tight first 10 pages, we have here one of the most enduring films of modern cinema. Modern cinema. 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 It's a weird word. Cinema. If you find yourself debating a movie with friends or people online, and you can't all agree on what works or what doesn't in that movie, it's probably because something went awry, usually in those first 10 pages.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me on the socials, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read.
The first 10 pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The first 10 pages, copyright 2025.